Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
I need to lose weight. Diet. Deprivation. Misery. Ugh.
What if you could lose weight without feeling awful? R3 Weight Loss by Susan Torberg is the real food plan you've been dreaming about. No calorie counting or journaling. A doable plan for real life. With R3 Weight Loss, you'll break those sugar and carb cravings but still be able to eat things you love, teaching you discipline and managing your weight for life. Visit r3weightlossplan.com. $39 will change your life.
And welcome to Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us tonight. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets. Attempting to bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Tonight, my guest John Tudorus and I go beneath the surface on the question of universal basic income, justice, or socialism. There he is, right next to me. I can almost... reach out and touch him, Mr. Ow. John. Oh. Mr. John Tudorus. John Tudorus.
Hey, hey, hey.
Hey, with the monkeys. That reminds me of the Monkeys theme song.
Isn't this great that we are like virtually in the same room?
We virtually are in the same room.
Yeah.
Yes. And it looks like you have a bookcase coming out of your head. You have a lot of good books there?
There's some. It's a bookcase in transition.
In transition, I bet you've read all of them, every single word of every one of those books,
oh,
I assume.
Oh, no. Some of them are actually, assuming that I have to submit an application for, but it's for my thesis. So some of them are for that.
Yes. By the way, if you're listening to us on the radio or later on our podcast, Beneath the Surface podcast, we also do this once in a while, as we are tonight, as a video cast. So we have it as both ways. So if you ever want to listen to us or watch us on video, actually, if you want to watch the video, go to paulmurano.com. That's Paul, M-U-R-A-N-O. The one word, paulmurano.com. And you can watch us on videocast. But if not, feel free to listen to us on Breadbox Media and all of its affiliates or wherever you find us on the internet.
Are you the video still on YouTube too? Oh, is it Beneath the Surface?
No. Yep, they're still on YouTube. It is called Beneath the Surface, but it's actually Veritas3737 if you go there. And it's either
I thought the name was changed recently.
Yeah, but I don't know how you get there. So
Well, when you pull up YouTube, they have this little magnifying glass you can click on, so you can search.
Okay.
And just Beneath the Surface, Paul Murano, and then booyah.
All right. There you go. Yeah, I know my handle is Veritas3737, but it is called, the page actually is called Beneath the Surface with Paul Murano. But anyway, that's John Tudorus. You are an extraordinaire of philosophy and theology, but today, or tonight, we are going to talk about something different. As a matter of fact, John, I don't think in the... 16 years of Beneath the Surface, the first 10 radio, the first 10 was local television, and the last 6 years, Beneath the Surface radio, I think in our entire existence, I'm not sure if we've ever had a show on economics or relating to economics.
Hmm.
We might have, but it's slipping my mind right now if we
not
have.
Not on any of the ones that I've been on, for sure.
Yes.
And I don't recall any of the ones that I've listened to have covered it, but it does. It is a very timely topic.
Well, it's always timely because the economy is like the lifeblood of a secular society. But it's particularly timely because a lot of the Democratic candidates are talking about, as far as I understand, the topic that we're going to touch upon tonight, which is universal basic income. And the general question that I have is it justice or is it socialism? And you know a lot more about economics than I do. I am a basic, I couldn't even write the book Economics for Dummies.
But that's okay because you are a philosopher. And sometimes it takes an outsider who has a little training upstairs on how to order their thinking right to ask the good questions.
And that's what I'm here for, to delve beneath the surface on this topic tonight. All right, so let's get started. This notion of universal basic income, it reminds me of parents giving children an allowance. Tell me how it's different and what is it?
Well, in some ways, it's very similar in the sense that children meet presumably certain criteria, and as a reward for doing so, they get a certain basic stipend to use. Maybe it's doing chores or what have you. But regardless, there's usually some minimum standard to get it. With the idea of a universal basic income, it's largely the same, but on a much more macro scale. So if we're thinking of something a bit more contemporary, think of on the economics, think of Social Security, right? So if someone reaches a certain age, what is it, like 63, 65 now?
At least 60, yeah.
Yeah, the age, I think, recently moved up a little, that you can put in your papers, and so long as you contribute a certain amount, you will get a certain amount back. And that's basically like a government retirement, right?
All right.
Stipend for existing.
It is. So let's just delve beneath the surface a little bit on that. The term Social Security, I find that an interesting term. It is security. It's financial security for people. Security for to stay afloat financially so that their basic needs are met. This was meant for those who are retired, and it was implemented, by FDR, for a post-World War II world in which people were mostly expected to maybe live a couple of few years after retirement, and if they didn't have any income, this would help them. A lot of people are saying that Social Security itself is too much of a social safety net, if you will, that it wasn't meant to be a continuous kind of thing, even for those who have the means. So when you say that UBI, or universal basic income, is a financial security for everybody, I mean, if Social Security is a problem, wouldn't this be even a bigger problem, or do I have it wrong?
No, you're actually in the right area. So, and these are some regarding Social Security, some of the problems with that. One is the how is it that we're funding it, right? There are some who have called it the world's biggest pyramid scheme. Not exactly, of course. I mean, it's used with a very broad brushstroke. And so there's a lot of finer differences, but just the general idea that those at the top who are getting paid out are essentially being funded by those in the bottom level paying into it. And at point,
with Social Security, it's the elderly are being paid for by the younger workers, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So, and but, it's contingent but, upon that.
But they have paid into the system, though, for all of their working life.
And presumably the funds have been invested and have not been dipped into the, depending upon the source you look at, they may have already been dipped into and may or may not be empty.
Right. But generically speaking, you're saying that this Social Security system we have today is similar to universal basic income that some of the Democratic candidates are speaking about right now, that that the government should give everybody, do I have this right? The government should give every family or every individual a certain amount of money right off the top every year. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's it in a nutshell. I'll give you a good example. Okay. So recently Ben Shapiro on his Sunday special had Andrew Yang, who is one of the candidates for the Democratic presidential election. And the version that he described would be like a dividend, allotment of $1,000 per month, so total of $12,000 per year.
For who?
For each individual person.
For each individual over 18?
Presumably adult. I don't know if they got that far into the description.
Okay.
And he said that was a magic number, in so much as that it was enough to give people something, but not so much that it didn't stifle or rather make people complacent so that they wouldn't work.
I see. So then this, what was the Democratic candidate's name again?
Andrew Yang.
Okay, so Andrew Yang said, basically he's saying he recognizes that government subsidies can cause dependence on people.
Yes.
And he's saying this kind of thing won't. He's saying that we should responsibly, as a government, as a nation, have the government give every individual a certain amount of money so that they can be above the poverty level, have a living wage.
So the $12,000 figure is actually, he noted, was below the poverty level. And he said, and that's one reason why it was a magic number, because it's almost like you're giving the taxpayer money back to the people, if you think of it that way. And he used, and I'll go into a little more later, he used the state of Alaska as an example, something they're currently doing right now. So basically taxpayer money goes in, and then some of it's really just getting kicked back, so to speak, but in an organized fashion. Ooh. So the state of Alaska, I mentioned, that they actually would get a dividend, and the taxpayers apparently actually voted this in. They said, and why they're calling it a dividend, I don't know, maybe because their taxpayer dollars are being invested on the side. So saying, let's basically give you a dividend back of $1,000 to $2,000 per year.
All right, before you start getting all financial talky with me, it seems like what you're saying now is something that Republicans might be able to get on board with, because it almost sounds like the kind of tax breaks that Donald Trump wants people to have. It's like you pay into the system, the government should pay you back a certain amount of money. No?
Well, if you remember in George W. Bush, when he was in, there was that tax rebate. I forget which year it was. I remember actually getting a check myself.
Yes.
I forget how much it was. And depending upon what level you're at, I think it was anywhere from like 500 to $1,000 to $2,000 or something.
Well, then how is that different than this? I don't know whether to look at this as a leftist socialist kind of program or a conservative tax break kind of program. How do you see universal basic income?
One is how it's implemented. I mean, the simplest solution to me would be just to reduce the taxes to begin with.
Right.
I mean, that was just thinking objectively, what are our options? One, reduce taxes altogether. Two is, well, you don't always know what you're going to need the tax dollars for. For example, if you're thinking about infrastructure, things like roads, public service buildings, etc., there's always going to be unforeseen expenses. So you say, okay, well, let's set a regular tax rate, have people pay into it, and presumably we're not wasting the money on any frivolous programs. We're using it for the things that we need, but we ought to, when the money comes in, invest it, right? So that we're actually building up the base. So it's not just the money we get from the taxpayers, we're actually increasing it. But now what do you do when you have excess? Well, what do companies do? Companies, they will return, they'll actually pay dividends, they get earnings, they pay those dividends to people. If you want to
government being governments, if they find they have an excess, wouldn't they find some place to use that money rather than giving it back to the people?
Many times they often do. That's where you get your $500 toilet seats from. Accounting.
Well, then what you're saying is it's a lot easier just to tax people less than to give them money back at the end of the year, right?
That's certainly one way to look at it. So that for the infrastructure. I mean, there's, and we won't get into it here, but there are debates on whether or not even the mandatory taxation is even legal or legit.
All right, we won't get into that here.
But presumably things are at the status quo now.
Well, I have a very basic question that's going to sound like perhaps a kindergarten is asking it, but that's okay. This is beneath the surface, so let's do it. Why do we get money back at the end of the year? Why not just tax us less so that the IRS doesn't have to be involved and we don't go through this whole rigmarole every single year by April 15th?
Oh, that's a good question. In fact, some people don't even wait to get money back at the end of the year. They'll actually they'll just pay what they need to. So if they're, for example, if they're, let's say they're in a retirement age, and they got a retirement account and they withdraw funds, they won't withhold taxes, and they'll just wait until the taxes come due. And some of them, their reasoning is that, well, it's my money. In the time that I have it, I'm going to invest it. So maybe I'll earn a few extra interest points on it, and I'll use it as I need to. And then only when I need to, will I then pay Uncle Sam. So not everyone has the mentality that I'm basically giving money to Uncle Sam up front, letting them invest it, make money off of that, and then just give me back the excess without any interest.
And there's a lot more to say about that, but I don't want to get into it right now.
Sure.
But universal basic income is basically giving you an allowance, giving every single person an allowance by the government, which to me says now the government has, if you know, a little power over you, because if they're the ones giving you a basic income, universal basic income, then they kind of have a say over perhaps how you live your life, what your values will be, what propaganda you will teach your kids.
Well, there is something to that, and that goes back to your question before: is this a like a tax rebate?
Right.
Are we seeing that as like a dividend? So we're basically just getting some of our money back, or is it being labeled and promoted as we are supplying basic well, fundamental needs for you?
Which one do you say it is out of those two?
I think some of it's really semantics. I don't know the full inner workings on how it works in the government, but presumably there's a certain amount of pool of tax dollars.
Yeah.
And how are they going to label it? If they label it as universal basic income and do it as such, I have a feeling just the name alone is going to cause people to slack off more, even if the amount given, such as what Andrew Yang proposes, is on a more minimalist level, so it's below the poverty line. It gives you something. You know, if you're frugal enough, you can keep housing, you can get cheap food, you can survive.
Sure.
You know, so if you were, let's say, in between jobs, you at least had something or what have you. But if you're thinking of it as basic income, it's like, yeah, I'm getting it from a source. I'm getting it from a benefactor.
It feels like you're getting it from above, and it's not your money that's coming back to you.
Right.
Yeah, it definitely, I mean, it's a different program. That's why the Democrats are talking about it this time. It's not like you're getting your money back on April 15th. It's something different, something differently implemented by the government so that the government can give you perhaps more money than you actually earned, right?
Well, it's entirely possible. That's correct. There is, effectively speaking, there is a real honest-to-goodness redistribution of wealth that goes on.
That's what I was getting at. Yes, yes.
Yes.
And that redistribution of wealth would rub conservatives the wrong way in this whole thing.
It can. It can. Yeah. I think it depends on how they're looking at it. I mean, the idea of universal basic income isn't old. There is a somewhat famous U.S. economist, Milton Friedman. In fact, if you look him up on YouTube, you can even see him on shows like Donahue when that was on. And somewhat of an interesting character, and while he would definitely be considered to be a bit more on the conservative side of things when it comes to economics, he did actually propose this idea and championed it.
Why? I mean, if he's on the conservative side of economics, what would his motive or reason be to propose this?
Largely the same as what I was hearing from Andrew Yang in his interview with Ben Shapiro, that it's providing some base level for people to operate on.
Okay.
So the idea is that you would greatly enhance the prospects of people not being in poverty, dying of starvation.
So it's what most people focus on, minimum wage. Let's raise that to become a living wage kind of idea. This is taking that, but going in another direction with it. Not only are you forcing or pressuring businesses to give people a higher living wage, you are actually giving people directly from the government that wage.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would say they would largely be in the same general category. Of course, one of the known issues with the minimum wage is when you increase the minimum wage, everything else rises. It's
rises,
like that old,
right.
The rising tides raises all ships. So then at some point, you defeat the purpose of the minimum wage.
It always, you know, just exactly what you said. It always interested me because it seems like minimum wage doesn't raising the minimum wage doesn't do anything unless you have a maximum wage. So it seems to me logic would have it that if you have a minimum wage, you should have a maximum wage. If you don't have a minimum wage, then you shouldn't have a maximum wage.
Well, there are some who have championed the idea from a socially conscious perspective of a maximum wage. For example, that a CEO should earn no more than 6 times the salary of the lowest paid worker of their company. Mm. That's, of course, not the case. It's effectively speaking uncapped. I mean, you look, you'll see CEOs or presidents, depending upon the deals that they strike or whether or not they're an owner or not. And how successful the company, they could be making not just in the millions, but in the tens of millions and
right.
even into the billions.
Right.
I mean, think of Mark Zuckerberg, right? Young yeah. whippersnapper CEO, younger than you and I, and he is worth billions. Once Facebook went public, yeah. He was an instant billionaire.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Now, with regard to the Catholic Church, the church basically is against unbridled capitalism and against socialism, which, you know, it leaves a big middle ground there for, you know, the church saying, you know, the rest is up to society because those two extremes are, you know, contradict the dignity of the human person, the extreme capitalism and the socialism. Would you say universal basic income, this notion we're talking about tonight, is closer to a socialist program or closer to a capitalist program?
That's a good question. And I would preface the statement by stating that our country does have some aspects of socialism that's been incorporated within some of the programs, like some of the social welfare programs already. So it's not completely foreign to this country. But I would also say that our country is not a full-blown capitalist economy.
Right.
I mean, I remember back in business school years ago, I think they mentioned Hong Kong was probably the most pure capitalism you'll find on the planet. But even then, that's the pure capitalism only existed in theory and not in practice. There's always mitigating factors.
Right. All right. Very interesting. Well, we need to take a quick break soon, but you've given us a good introduction to think about. And when we come back, John is going to school me a little more on economics and what this universal basic income might mean if it's implemented. And we'll talk more about what else the Democratic candidates are proposing with regard to the economy. I think after the break, we also need to talk about what should be implemented with regard to a state and a nation? Because obviously things that are implemented in the family, like allowances, may or may not work, or perhaps shouldn't be even tried on the state or the local or the national level. So we'll talk all about that and the principle of subsidiarity. Paul Morano here with Beneath the Surface, my guest John Tudoris. Be back right after this quick break. Don't go away. Welcome back, Beneath the Surface. Glad you could join us for segment number two, my guest, Mr. John Tudoris. And tonight, we delve beneath the surface on the topic of universal basic income. And it's the first time I've heard of it. John had alerted me to it, that there are Democratic candidates that are talking about this. And I'm trying to figure out with John whether this is kind of a socialist program or is it more of a tax break kind of thing. And it seems to me, John, that like we were talking about last break, it is the government's redistributing wealth in a way that the government will find to be just and fair, particularly for those who are under the poverty line. No?
Well, that was certainly one proposal. I mentioned Andrew Yang in his interview with Ben Shapiro. That was his proposal. And he was on the Democratic side of things, he was definitely more of a doer than he wasn't a career politician at all. He He was a businessman. I think he was a lawyer, too, when I looked him up. So he's definitely gotten his feet wet in the world.
Well, what did Shapiro say about this idea?
Gads, he was talking so fast.
All right. You probably don't remember. All right. Well, before the break, we had talked about whether such an idea of redistribution for the sake of the very poor is the idea of the government giving each person and each family an allowance. If that works in the family, does it also translate to working in the state or the federal level? What say you about that?
Well, there are a few differences. One, of course, is the scale of economy. Anytime you have larger scales of economy, you get additional layers, elements that aren't there on the smaller, more basic level. That's one point to consider. The second is, in a family, when the children are getting allowances, that's exactly it. They're children.
Yes.
So they're in a stage of development where they're actually aspiring to, at some point, get out of the house, get off on their own. So getting a stipend from the parents for maybe doing chores or something along those lines basically is part of the whole education process of getting them so that they can launch successfully.
Well, this brings us to the philosophical question of what is a nation? You know, what is a country? Is a nation really an extended family? And if so, if we do see it in that kind of model, then aren't there parental figures involved, i.e. the governments? Or is it not?
Analogous to parental figures. I mean, there's two main ways of looking at a government, and we largely get those from Aristotle and Plato. You know, Plato in his Republic started his mock ideal government not with families as the basic unit, but with functions. The butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they all get together, they start trading. Before you know it, you have a government. You know, whereas Aristotle understood that even beyond those functions themselves is the natural society of the family.
But is a nation a natural extension of the family? Is a nation a large extended family?
It's communal, for sure.
Okay, so then...
And nations certainly have identities, absolutely.
Then with every structure, and the family has a structure, so does the nation. With every structure, there is a hierarchical structure of authority, is there not? With the family, there's the father, there's the mother, there's the children.
Yep.
What is it with the nation? I know every nation is different. There's capitalism, there's totalitarian nations, there are democracies. But just in general, the generic basic idea of nation, who are the authority figures, and how much authority should they have over, say, the economy and the families involved in the nations and businesses?
That is a very good and fair question.
We should do a whole beneath the surface on that question. I know it's a tangent, but it really kind of relates to what we're talking about.
It is. It very much is. I mean, really, you're looking at, if you use a broad brushstroke, that's part of the main differences between, you know, and here we're talking about not the way it's often practiced, but the ideal of the Democrats and the Republicans. Republicans would be the conservative party, where they're actually looking to interpret and act upon the running of the country according to our founding documents. Whereas the left would largely say, well, they're living documents, you know, times change, people change, we're progressing.
Right, but both parties at least give lip service to the fact that we're a democratic republic, right?
Yes.
They just have different ideas of what a democratic republic should act like. And so if you see the nation as a family model, basically what you're saying is, what are the roles of these family members in this nation? And what authority do they have?
Well, I would only say that they're analogous to families, but I would not call them a family model.
Okay.
Right. But, you know, for example, in a family model, you basically have a monarchy, assuming the father, mother, children.
True.
It's a monarchy, and there's really no creativity.
That's the government of the family.
Yes.
So you're saying the government of a nation is different than that, but the nation itself, is there a family model to the nation itself? Don't even talk about the government yet.
Sure.
Okay. So then it's the extended family of a nation should be governed by something much more loose, if you will, than how the family is governed.
Well, a nation would be an extension of the older tribal models.
Right. Okay. But the tribes had chieftains, right?
Yep. Tribes have chieftains, you know, feudal Europe and feudal Japan.
Right.
You know, they had their shoguns, they had their local kings.
Right. And eventually, you know, Europe had kings for the longest period of time until the democratic movement of the modern age. But I guess what we need to try to figure out here in a democratic republic is how much authority does the government have with our money? And how much responsibility does the government have with those who are below the poverty line? I'll give it to you.
On the conservative side, the answer would be very, very little. The idea is that the government would provide a basic structure, sort of the framework itself. And this gets to the point you mentioned before the break, the principle of subsidiarity, is that their proper purview would be just the things at the high level. So where it's the infrastructure, this is what we're concentrated on. So for example, if I work for a really large company, the CEO, I mean, he's 10 levels above the guy on the front line or the lady on the front line.
Right.
And he's not going to know what they do on a day to day. So, you know, what happens if someone goes in and let's say they write a letter of complaint or a letter of praise, and they send it to the attention of the CEO because they want things to be taken care of.
Yeah.
What's going to happen? It's going to go all the way to the top. It's just going to filter all the way down to the person or persons who would actually effectively handle it at that level.
I am smiling because we just saw a television show tonight on that exact idea. What was the name of that show? Do you remember? Okay, the TV show with the boss who, undercover boss, and something like undercover boss. It was on cable television.
Oh yeah, yeah, I've seen a few of those.
Where the owner or the highest CEO or whoever he is, he takes on he either shaves his head or he takes on some kind of costume or some kind of way so that they wouldn't recognize him. And then he goes in and he works with the lowest of his company. They don't know who he is. And by the end of the show, the owner, has such a greater appreciation for what they go through and the poverty that many of them live in, that by the end of the show, the owner is usually crying or, you know, giving, you know, writing a check to all of these people that he worked with saying, you know, I didn't realize how bad this was for you. I don't know. Maybe they do that for dramatic effect. I'm sure they do. But That's the reason why I was smiling when it comes to what you were saying. Sometimes the 1% do know and do appreciate what their workers are going through.
Yeah.
So should the government get involved?
So back to what I mentioned before if we were looking on the conservative side, government through the principle of subsidiary would only cover the highest functions. And they wouldn't invade in the space of the lower levels because those on the lower level would be more apt to manage those affairs. And the main criteria for this to function properly is you had to have a moral people. If you don't have a moral people who are trained to basically self-govern themselves, they will naturally, nature abhors a vacuum, so they will naturally look for guidance from somewhere else, and actually the look above.
In other words, what you're saying is a basic principle here: the less self-governance there is, the more external governance there needs to be, or there will be.
It will automatically.
And what we mean by self-governance is we need self-discipline. Basically, we need virtue, right? Virtuous people.
Oh yes.
So what you're saying is basically what many of the founding fathers had said, and that this democracy or this republic that we are creating here is not going to work without a virtuous people.
Correct.
All right.
If we all learn to be virtuous people and to learn how to take care of ourselves and, you know, when needed, take care of others, take care of our family, etc. At some point in our life, all of us need taken care of. You know, at a very minimum, the very young need taken care of and the very old.
Yeah.
And sometimes those in between need help taken care of. But if most people really sought to take care of themselves in the right way, that would actually function. And it would function quite well and in a very healthy way.
And there would be needy people, but those needy people would be basically maybe those who are, you know, mentally challenged or have other physical, you know, challenges or for some reason can't work. All of those things you're saying with the principle of subsidiarity would be taken care of by the lowest levels first. The family, the church, which of course is the highest level, but at least economically, it's the local
business giving to the homeless shelter.
The local business, right? The parish, the local organizations, nonprofit organizations, all those, the neighborhoods,
right?
All of those things would pitch in first to ensure that the truly needy are taken care of. And then maybe the local government, and if that doesn't work, you're saying the state government, if that doesn't work, ultimately the federal government. But it really shouldn't get up that high, right?
The only time is in extreme cases. And I'll use an ancient example for this. It's Old Testament, and we have Joseph in Egypt, right? So this is Joseph. If anyone's seen the musical Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, same character.
Yeah.
So long story short, his brothers ditch him for dead. Literally, they leave him in a ditch for dead,
yeah.
In a well. And he ends up getting sold in slavery, ends up in Egypt, and becomes the Grand Vizier. And basically, he gets this prophecy that there's going to be a great, great famine. So what does he do is he plans wisely for this great, great disaster that's going to befall the entire area, this great, great drought, and they store grain ahead of time. And then what ends up happening is they become a resource for not just their own country in their time of need, but they have such a plenty because they were disciplined and virtuous in how they did it that they were able to supply for even neighboring countries and neighboring peoples who asked for help. So it's not foreign that even on the greatest level that there would be some sort of, break glass in emergency so that you have this,
right.
But the idea would be that it's not the norm.
Yeah. Right. So in emergencies, the national level will get involved and even the international level.
Yes.
But like you said, those are emergencies.
Right.
Yet, we have a program. We have national programs like Social Security and Medicare, which now...
And welfare,
which now everybody loves and clings to. And however, is this really... does it pass the principle of subsidiarity?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't?
Nope, not even close.
Well, would programs like these, and even what we're talking about tonight, universal basic income... could you make an argument that it passes subsidiarity on the level of the state or the Commonwealth? Not the federal, but the state.
It is certainly a way to shift it, right? So on a national level, they could say, well, all right, here we go. We're going to set up a basic framework, and then we're going to... on a national level, we'll give a very, very small portion, and then we'll leave the rest to the states, for example.
But I'm even saying, why shouldn't the federal government get involved at all? Why even have that?
I agree. Honestly, I'm not a fan of it. I think it's contrary to our human nature. That's my opinion.
But do you think subsidiarity is good? It passes subsidiarity if it's on the state level, is what I'm asking you.
So if an individual state... wanted to do so. Thing is, one is the state doesn't bring enough in tax revenue, which means they're going to need to increase taxes so that they can basically redistribute wealth.
Pretty much. I mean, RomneyCare for Massachusetts.
Yeah.
It was, I think it was the first state to try something like socialized medicine.
Yep.
Or to socialize it. And,
It was the model for Obamacare.
It was the model for Obamacare. And when Romney was running for president, he was against having this at the federal level, but he's saying states are like little laboratories to which you can try to implement things like this Do you disagree?
He's certainly onto something in the sense that on smaller levels, some things may, we'll put work in quotation marks, although they would work better than on the federal level. Because the federal level, you just get these big, there's too many layers.
Exactly.
Nancy Pelosi, how much is Obamacare going to cost once it's implemented? Oh, well, pass the bill and you'll find out. I mean, you know, trillions of dollars later.
Yeah. Well, then I think that most, if not all, conservatives agree that there should be some safety nets, even on the federal level, to some degree or another, but mostly on the state and local levels. This universal basic income idea of giving each individual an allowance, would you say that this is something that would be embraced by millennials?
Depends on where they came from.
Younger people.
I mean, I would say millennials often get grouped together, I think unfairly, as irresponsible, glued to their smartphones, full of themselves, posting Instagram shots, taking pictures of every single one of their meals.
No, I know that, but there are a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s that are saying, this marriage family thing is just impossible economically. How am I going to pull this off? Whereas in past generations, of course, it was, you know, a guy went to work and he could have a living wage for his whole family.
Sure.
It's not that way anymore. So would you say that younger generations find this more attractive and more just because of the financial world that they live in today?
Not just, but more attractive in some ways, some will. And again, we're using very broad brushstrokes here.
Sure.
One reason why they're finding the difficulty of marriage is because they have multiple generations. We're talking 2, 3, 4 generations deep of broken families where they don't see this living model. So if someone grows up, and I've seen it, they grow up in a family where they see the parents stay together, they make things work, they have siblings, and it's very clear that everyone cares for each other. It's more organic and natural for them to go out and do the same thing versus someone who came from a single parent or divorced family, it's shelling back and forth, and they don't see any sort of unity in this. And it's very discouraging, but that they have this internal instinct and urge to mate and want to procreate and be with another, the opposite sex.
And there's where a lot of trouble happens.
Lots of trouble.
Well, nature is saying one thing, and the society and its social structure is saying another thing. And there's a lot. And of course, we do many beneath the surfaces on that topic. And of course, the virtue is very, very important when it comes to that. I was just going to say, you're right that the broken family, the post 1960s broken family, is definitely involved in this whole thing. It's involved in most of what is broken today in our culture, but one effect of that, which is women, you know, going back to work in droves after the invention of the birth control pill and its popularization, you know, having 5 to 8 children per family to, you know, 1.4 almost overnight in our society. This has really made the economy shift itself or reorganize itself to make two income families necessary to stay afloat.
On the coastal areas, more so with the inflated real estate, it makes it much, much more difficult. You get parts in the deep South, middle America. It's a lot easier to have a one income family. Mm. And then we're not even talking grand jobs. We're talking, you know, run of the mill. I work in the factory. If you budget well, you can have a single family. Whereas on the coastal areas, like in the Northeast, over on the West Coast, where real estate is largely inflated compared to much of the rest of the country,
yeah,
it's not impossible, but it surely is a lot more difficult.
And of course, if you sacrifice a lot of what the world tells you that you need.
Oh, sure. You can make it, from a socialization standpoint. You
can make it happen.
Even if a woman says, I want to raise children. I want to be there for them in their early ages. They are lacking the social net themselves. Yeah. They actually have an extra sacrifice there. And why is that? Because many of the women that they would normally, look, 50, 100 years ago, they would be their neighbors. They would have to be able to talk to an adult instead of just talking to 2 and 3 year olds.
Not only has the family broken down, but the neighborhood is broken down.
Yes.
And I think this all relates to the popularization of the birth control pill and women going out to work and making the neighborhoods, that way, but stale and so forth. But that's another show. We only have about a minute left. Do you live in the state of Rhode Island?
I do.
All right. In your state, if your governor said we're going to implement universal basic income,
I would vote against it.
So in the state of Rhode Island, it would not be good. In any state, would it be good?
No. And Rhode Island is the smallest of all states.
All right. So you are against this idea.
Yep. The more I think about it, Plato was against it. It was one step between the democratic state to the totalitarian state. Was the redistribution of wealth. I think he was right 2,400 years ago. I'll go with Plato on this one.
And the more power you give to the state or the governments, the more power they have over you.
That is also naturally correct.
All right. You're listening to Beneath the Surface, Paul Marano with John Tudorus. Tonight we've been talking about, and we usually don't go beneath the surface on financial issues, but in economic issues, talking about the universal basic income idea that some Democrats are choosing to talk about. Any last words, John, on this notion before we call it a night?
I think we covered a lot of the basics. I would say if you're still for it, reconsider. Human nature doesn't change. It's read up on the last one-third of Plato's Republic, where he goes through all the various city-states. Granted, they're on a smaller scale, but there's a lot that applies to today. Read it, chew on it, and look at the last two, the democratic state, one step away from the totalitarian state, and some of those things that he identifies there, the actions that happen, we see those in play right now.
And you think this is one more further action towards that?
It's a redistribution of wealth at the end of the day, no matter how you label it.
There he is, ladies and gentlemen, John Tudorus. Thanks, John, for delving beneath the surface on this topic that I know very little about. And thank you for listening to Beneath the Surface tonight. Again, you've been listening to Beneath the Surface with Paul Marano. Thanks you could join us. Join me on my Facebook, on my website, my personal website, paulmarano.com, and have a great evening. And we'll see you next time. Beneath the Surface.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture. Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com.
Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.